Dystopias this week on Destructomundo.
Witnesses to the affected people who acted as though they were in a kind of trance were killing and eating their victims, prompted authorities to examine the bodies of some of the victims. Medical authorities in Cumberland have concluded that in all cases, the killers are eating flesh. Repeating this latest public health issue from the town, civil defense authorities have told you
my whole life for Dystopia.
Ted's back.
It's the return of Ted.
Ted is back. We're here tonight, all four of us, for the inaugural four-person episode. We're here to Wonder Twin Powers activate.
Two sets of Wonder Twin?
Yeah, Adam, we'd like to welcome back Adam.
Welcome.
You can't nod on the radio.
All right.
Just speak into the little thing.
Yeah, they got the... the microphone machine?
Yep.
Speak into the robot.
Yeah, we want to help welcome Adam and Ted. Ted's back.
Mm-hmm.
Ted was learning the law. Ted's becoming...
Well, that's what I like to say.
Yeah.
So he can destabilize from the inside?
Well, Ted's becoming a judge, you know, like Judge Dredd. He gets his flying motorcycle
Judge
and...
Judge Judy.
And such. Yeah, like Judge Judy. Only.
Does she have a flying motorcycle?
Yeah. I think so. She's like one of the ones that...
She would be like a really good villain in the dystopia.
Sure. Well, I mean, Judge Dredd is a dystopia.
Judge Dredd is a dystopia.
It's a futuristic one city...
where all the cops are judges.
So is Martial Law.
Yeah.
Which was much better than Judge Dredd, I thought.
It does have more flesh to it than Judge Dredd did. Judge Dredd was a little bit more fast action comic book style with a lot of, like, not necessarily super villains, but really over the top stuff going on, you know. Mm. And they even went so far as to have, like, the forces of nature type judges, you know, that were, like, you know, evil manifestations. They had, like, Judge Death and, can't remember the other ones, Judge Fear. And they all had, like, different, they looked like judges, but they were, like, you know, four horsemen type guys and stuff, so.
Hmm.
But where Martial Law had, like,
bondage gear.
Yeah, right.
And an arm wrapped in barbed wire.
Yeah, because that was how that's
mask.
How to take care of the...
leather pants, leather mask, boots with spurs, and an arm
so maybe
wrapped
you should
in barbed
define dystopia for people who
don't
know what it is.
For people who didn't go to school.
Does anybody else want to tackle that? I mean, what a dystopia is?
Dystopia?
Dystopia. It's the opposite of utopia. Utopia is not, like, like the word topia. Or topos, Latin, means place, but then, like, utopia doesn't mean good place. It just means, like, unless you're considering it with an E on the front, and it would have, like, a good connotation.
Okay.
It would be like euphoria. Like, if you took the E,
okay.
U.
Like Europe?
Or Europe, which isn't a good place either. You'll do it like that.
Okay.
But that's what it's supposed to mean, is good.
But, dystopia is it's a very, very bad place, right? In a
For
nutshell?
For most people,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's a society where, for whatever reason, I mean, there's obviously different ways that it can manifest itself, but obviously, I guess, life for the common individual is... unspeakably unpleasant.
Yeah, it's very bleak. A lot of fear.
Whether it's through, like, you know, the actual, like, you know, physical victimization or, you know, just the loss of personal freedom or just...
That's often
extreme poverty or lack of resources or whatever.
Yeah, fear, loss of freedom.
Lots of pollution.
Lots of, you know, just bad stuff all around. But generally,
really
they're...
crappy gin.
Yeah. Victory gin. Yeah, you get your good victory gin on. Which brings us to probably where we should start is the granddaddy of them all, really, is 1984. The George Orwell. And in that, he's describing a totalitarian state called Oceania, and made up of like three different sort of countries that are banded together under that name, and then like their England has become Airstrip One, which I think is a reference to its use in World War II as like the place where everything was launched, and the reason why it's called Airstrip One. And Winston Smith is the main character in the book, and he works in the Ministry of Truth, which is the propaganda ministry, the Ministry of Lies. Everything, it's, backwards like that.
Yeah.
It's like Bizarro World.
Bizarro England? But yeah, that's a place where, obviously, the individual is reduced to just a component in an enormous machine, basically. Everybody, no one has any sort of significance to their individual life. I mean, they all exist purely
for the good of the state.
For the good of the state. And then there's the whole sort of manufactured, the war with Eurasia.
Yeah.
Which
thing. Is a... In the
and it's like, it's just, it's continued because that gives everybody something to focus on. And they can, that's the reason that we do all this stuff. And so everybody does everything, to sort of help, to win the war. So
yeah, also like Goldberg and all the counter-revolutionaries.
Yeah.
All the people who want to bring down the party.
Yeah, you've got to have this, it's, the us and them thing. You got to create a them to, sort of solidify the us. Like if you've got, the...
And it helps if you're able to control the them. It weeds out the people that you're looking that might not, your thought criminals.
Yeah.
Because that's a common theme in the book is that not only doing an action is wrong that hurts the state, but thinking it is wrong.
You've got a society where everything is so incredibly, controlled down to the most minute details by the sort of inner circle of the elite, the few people that are really running things, and everyone else is so completely nullified almost as an individual. The most horribly criminal things you can do is to actually, think freely about and want to do stuff that would make you happy. Everything is... that's a perfect perfect example.
Well, what's wrong with any of that?
If you're one of the people in power?
Sure.
Nothing, probably. It's pretty nice, I imagine, but...
Want a bunch of yahoos running around thinking for themselves?
Of course, there's the ever-present.
They can all go to Canada if they want to do that.
See, yeah. And Canada isn't mentioned in it. Of course, no countries are mentioned by name.
They sort of do. They refer to what is obviously North America.
Well, continental.
Being part of the, they don't mention the countries, but they mention, the other part of Oceania
Yeah, it's sort of assumed that maybe England and the United States are part of one country. And I would assume being that, Canada and the United States are so close that they became one country and one part of Oceania.
The English speaking nations, and then you've got Eurasia, which they kind of allude to being dominated by kind of a Soviet style Russia, and then Pacifica? Is that the third one?
I think so.
I think that sounds right.
They just always refer to them as, Asian people.
Yes.
Well, then there's the ever-present Big Brother, which is the theme of the book, is that you cannot go where Big Brother is not watching you. Or you think you can kind of maybe go to, where the proletariat, the proles are, and hang out in the slums where they don't really monitor as much, but in the end it really turns out that everything is monitored. It's an illusion that you're able to
It's the example of the sort of ultimate government involved in every aspect of your life, down to where you're never have any sort of real privacy. You're never ever alone, because wherever you are, Big Brother's watching.
Yeah,
so your whole life is controlled completely. and you have no, like I said, no sense of personal freedom at all, because you're, because that would, that would be contrary to the wishes of the state.
Yeah, and even more so, the whole, like, reduction of language manifested in Newspeak, where you're able to condense down language to its basest form, to where there's no need for thought about how to say something. You know, if it's bad, it's not, you know, and they do it in such a way that it's like there's good, and instead of being a different concept entirely for bad, you just make it ungood. So you have the the added effect of making something bad seem less unpleasant because you're making it ungood. You have the word good to remind you what good is in there, and then bad.
Yeah, I mean, if you, I guess that's, you know, that's the government even controlling the words that you're allowed to use.
Exactly. They're controlling your thoughts by controlling the language in order for you to to have less and less freedom over what you're able to think. Because if you're not able to think a crime, you can't produce, you can't perform a crime. And then, and then that, and then that, you have like the different elements of Winston Smith's becoming an enemy of the state, where he, you know, falls in love, or what he believes, you know, is love, and has a sex crime, where basically he just goes someplace in the slums, and then has what the state considers promiscuous sex with a person, and then
without the intention of,
I forget what's the girl, you've read this,
Julie,
yeah, but he went to a hooker before that.
Yeah, he goes to the prole sector or whatever it is,
yeah,
because they have prostitutes there. Which that is, they seem somewhat, it's a lot, not necessarily tolerated, but sort of accepted, because they're proles, and proles are kind of subhuman, so they're known to sort of, you know, engage in acts like that. I mean, this, you know, but for someone who's not a prole to go there and participate in it is like, you know, horrific. But
well, then there's the subsequent turning of the two against each other.
Yeah. I mean, you don't, I mean, you know, the, it's just, like I said, it's just, it's such a great, it's a perfect example of, like, the state controlling everything.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, you know, you look at every aspect of the individual's lives is controlled, to the point where, I mean, they can just.
Including the past.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, the book basically opens up with
Winston. The past is rewritten to,
writing about
to justify the present, you know what I mean,
And inserting, like, soldiers' names into heroic acts in order to give the people something to read about that, you know, gives the war a good light. And
well, he was a proofreader, so he would go, and, like, if someone became a non-person, he would go back and erase everything that documented that person had ever existed.
Yeah.
And so they would be like, well, that guy never existed. You're making him up.
Well, it also gives us a unique insight into what the mechanics of the system is that the war may not even be a real thing. I mean, it's, you don't ever see anybody who has fought in the war.
Yeah.
Like walking the streets. You don't see the casualties of war like you would see in a mechanized war, especially one where modern medicine has prevailed, and see like one-legged people walking around.
Yeah, there's just, like, there's the daily newsreels.
And then there's the, like, occasional, like, rocket attack against the city. Kind of like the V1, V2 attacks.
Yeah. But there's no...
But those could be engineered.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when you have the like, resistance is an engineering construct of the state, you know, anything is possible. Especially when they give the illusion that you're not being watched in the slums, when you indeed are, because the picture falls off the wall, and there's the Big Brother screen, the telescreen, showing that he's been watched.
That's, you know, it's the archetypal example of that, you know, government totally taking over everything.
But then them having control over your basest fears as well, in the room 101 where they go, and they take Julia and Winston to be tortured.
Dude, you're giving it all away, man.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
If you haven't read 1984, God, go watch it. At least watch the movie or
something. The movie's pretty good.
The movie's good enough to... Yeah, go buy Cliff's Notes. I can't imagine anybody listening to this show hasn't had
some...
Or you could
go get totalitarianism for dummies.
Brush with 1984 in some way or another.
Dystopia for dummies?
But, right.
Or you could... Well, what about the Van Halen?
Van Halen for dummies?
Little baby angel shouldn't smoke cigarettes? Is that what you're trying to say?
Hey, I got nothing against that. I'm not controlling people's lives. And I'm not going to tell you what to do and what not to do.
Yeah.
But that's just me. I'm just like that.
So. Well, they kicked David out after that album.
Yeah.
Because of drug crimes.
Wow.
James is making stuff up.
Yeah. Well, I think that's why they actually did. He's just obnoxious. But he rocked.
He rocked. He rocked way too
hard.
I'll
say it here. David Lee Roth rocked.
They were tired of his really
Not by
tight
himself,
pants.
Though. He needed Eddie. But they need each other. They just don't talk to each other. They don't like each other.
They just never admit that they need
it's
each other.
It's a bad relationship. But they don't work well by themselves. It's sad. Very sad.
So that's one kind of dystopia.
And then there's... Yeah, that basically... That covers the totalitarian dystopia so well that there really isn't even any need to go any further with the types of totalitarian regimes.
Yeah, I mean, there's been other things like that, but like I said, it's the sort of a modern archetype of that, you know.
That's like one extreme. I mean, the other extreme is like the total lack of that, which would be anarchy.
Yeah,
complete anarchy.
Well, there's the bureaucratic type of dystopia where you basically have like what took place in the movie Brazil, where it's like there isn't necessarily a totalitarian government controlling your every thought and action, but there is one that's trying to uphold the law or to be able to make everything conform to the law of the land, to where you have to, everything, every single aspect of your life is controlled by law.
Yeah.
So you don't have any freedom to move around.
It's just
within.
The hell of paperwork.
Yeah,
exactly. Everything's been so...
Everything has to be submitted in triplicate. Yeah. Everything has to be done to the letter, or else it gets kicked back through the machinery, and it takes forever to have anything done.
That movie borrowed a lot from Kafka.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially, like, The Castle.
It's...
Where it's just like, you know, it was The Castle, it was like some messenger had to get to some important government official, and he just have to keep going through gates and showing his papers to different gatekeepers or something like that.
It's like the DMV gone mad.
Yeah, basically.
Well, it is. Just, I mean, it's social commentary indeed on like the style of life that the bureaucrats seem like they would want us to have. You know, because nothing is easy, nothing is logical. Everything's done for the. It's like paperwork for paperwork's sake. And it doesn't seem like anything makes sense. And then there lies the rub. None of this makes any sense. We're all doing this for nothing.
It was also kind of like a dictatorship of the mediocre.
Well, the funny thing about that movie is that the rebellion is to have things done, you know, expeditiously. Like,
yeah.
You have, like...
Efficiently, yeah.
Yeah, you have, like, the problem in the apartment where, you know, his everything's going haywire and... You know, nothing, and then he calls in the guerrilla repairman to come and fix his apartment, and finding that out, the people that actually do that work go and screw up his apartment even worse just to get back at him for having him there to fix it right the first time. They tear it all apart, and he's like, I had it fixed. They're like, oh, but we had to unfix what he did in order to fix it the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
Of course, in that movie, you know, there are parallels to 1984. It borrows sort of heavily in the visualization of it, but with him basically not wanting to be a drone anymore and working, you know, in this office. And I love some of the stuff that happens in that with the desk being like between the two walls and like him, you know, having to pull it into his office, and because the guy in the other office is pulling it to where he basically doesn't have any desk left at all. Yeah. And the computers are just like the monitor on top of the box, and it's just the screen and nothing surrounding it and everything. Yeah. You have to speak into stuff.
It's sort of, it's that, you know, the, what we have today, I guess, with, you know, like the office drone in the cubicle.
Yeah.
you know, that sort of thing just taken to a greater degree, you know.
Yeah, and all the
turned stuff into like an absurd parody of it.
Well,
to show, you know.
Anybody who's ever had to deal with any type of bureaucracy can see that that's the way that things would go if left unchecked. Like, you know, if you've ever had a job where they ask you to submit any request for days off 3 weeks in advance. You know, I've had jobs like that, and it's awful. But, you know, it's like, who can pattern out their lives enough to where every day off they need is known 3 weeks in advance? I mean, like, as if you're going to be able to do that. And they sort of have you by the balls in that sort of situation. Where
you're just a drone.
Yeah.
That's kind of a common theme in a lot of Terry Gilliam movies. They did that in, Baron Munchausen, when they're in that one, like, the democratic city-state that's being surrounded by the emperor or whatever, and they're under siege. And they're like, this young man who happened to be Sting was, like, single-handedly repulsed an attack. You know, like, oh, we're going to have you executed.
Yeah.
Like, why? He's like, well, you're being heroic. That's not, you know, in the regulations.
Yeah. Yeah, he's about a bureaucracy. I think he likes to make fun of those sort of things. And then, you know, that's that type of it's a humorous take on that type of dystopia for sure. I mean, because there are subjects that can't be taken as humorously, but like you really 1984 is so bleak that it really lacks any humor at all.
Yeah.
And then Brazil sort of makes it, you know, takes it to the humorous level, but
darkly
it makes
humorous.
It makes it more into satire, which is I believe is as important as a serious take, because then, you know, it gives you, like, it allows you to kind of like sit, you know, it deals with a different emotion. It's not so much a intellectual one as it is a, you know, you feel it more than you know it. I think that's important.
Yeah, I agree.
But yeah, in that sense,
you don't walk out of it feeling devastated.
No,
I mean,
no.
You get the point.
Yeah,
you know, but you don't feel like you've been punched in the stomach.
Sure, you know, by the fact that you had somebody with a cage of rats put on their face.
And yeah,
scared so bad that it changed their personality. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's.
But yeah, you wind up with that kind of theme, you know, in a lot of dystopias where it's basically fear more than anything else drives it. The main character is oftentimes very, very small, insignificant.
Yeah, I mean that's basically, like I said, you've got the sort of the common person is reduced to virtual insignificance. I mean, there's like one person in charge generally, or like a, you know, a small group of the elite. But basically the average person, their life is just complete and absolute shit. You know, whether it's active, like they're actively subjugated or whatever, like in the case of 84 or something. Or but something like Soylent Green. You've got basically there's the small, like the corporate bigwigs that are living comfortably. Because that's mostly a dystopia due to is there like lack of resources,
overpopulation,
you know, there's pollution in the oceans, pollution on the land, so there's not enough food to go around. All the urban centers are massively overpopulated because you can't live outside the urban centers.
Yeah,
because what little land is still good is the huge privately owned farms that produce stuff for like the few rich people, but everybody else is living in the city and they're living off of what is effectively like
food pills.
Almost, you know, like the welfare handout stuff.
Yeah.
They got to go daily to get their food and water. You get a daily ration.
Well,
and, you know,
it's the beast of mankind has become so large. It's like your only job is to feed it.
Yeah, I mean, there's
you're maintaining it. The giant machinery that has to be in place for people to be able.
But I mean, you watch
to
survive. And that movie, you know, that movie's not like terrifically, you know, sci-fi'd out. I mean, it's pretty stripped down. It's pretty raw, and it's incredibly fucking bleak. I've never read that book. I've never read the book that it's based on. I have a copy, but I've never read it.
I've read it. As far as Ellison's work goes, it's
Harrison.
It's Olson.
It's Harrison.
You sure?
I'm sure.
I think it's Harlan Ellison.
No, it's
Harrison.
Harry,
who?
It's Harry Harrison.
You sure about that?
Yes.
Okay. Well,
we'll fight after the show.
Oh, okay. We'll duke it out.
We'll have a steel cage.
At any rate,
we'll have a knife fight in the kitchen.
It is a really
is that the stainless steel rat guy.
Yes.
Okay.
Did he write that? Are you sure?
It's called Make Room, Make Room.
Yeah, I knew that.
And it's written by Harry Harrison.
I've read all the stainless steel rats, and I just didn't even notice. Okay, all right.
Anyway,
maybe I haven't read Elsa.
But I mean, I've seen the movie many times. It's a pretty bleak, and obviously, you know, the end, which again I won't give away because there's somebody that has not seen Silent Green.
Oh my God, I don't care about that guy.
I'll say it. You fucking suck if you've never seen Silent Green. But.
Oh,
or if
okay.
You at least don't know it.
No. I mean, it's just the overpopulation dystopia isn't.
It's not necessarily just that. It's the whole, I mean, there's like I said, it's just the lack of basic resources.
Well, that's
because space is a resource. There's no space.
Space is a resource.
There's no food. There's no water.
Food is a resource. Fuel in order to make the machinery run.
Yeah.
All these.
Because he has to ride the little stationary bike to charge up the batteries to have light, you know. You've got nothing. You've just got because it's set in New York City and the population in the movie. New York's population is like 20-something million or something. I mean,
it's much larger than it actually is now, but I think they're at 11 million in New York.
But I mean, that was 73, so that
seemed
pretty wild at the time.
Its main theme is about like limited resources. And
yeah, but then,
exhaustion
but then
of those
he,
resources.
You know, he's when he goes to investigate the murder of this one of the executives of the Soylent Corporation. This guy's got this huge apartment. I mean, this guy's one apartment is the space of like you know. That five or six families would get where Thorne lives, the cop that Heston plays. You know, this guy's got this huge apartment. He's got air conditioning and a refrigerator. You know, and it like totally blows his mind when he walks in there, like that people live like that. And it's basically like a penthouse, you know, big apartment building where all the rich guys live. You know, and the common man they live in squalor and in like huge slum, rundown apartment buildings.
Notice how they eat real food.
Oh yeah, the guy's got steak. The guy's got vegetables. There's that.
Well, I mean, he works
little bottle of like strawberry jam that they're like, holy shit!
Yeah,
I was like the one where and like there's the bottle of whiskey and they have the girls that live with them that they call furniture. Like the girl comes with the apartment, and if you don't want her, you can trade her in for another one. But like the apartment comes with a girl. But he's got the cigarettes. Like, he finds the rich guy's cigarettes, and he lights one up, and he's like, you know, if I had the money, I'd smoke three or four of these a day, you know?
Right.
It's like a big deal to get a cigarette, but it's that, you know, the sort of rich get richer, poor get poorer type of thing taken to an incredible extreme, you know, to where the average people just are living like animals, and you know, but that's a, you know, it's just the basic lack of resources for the average person.
And eventually, especially, I mean,
and you've got a small group of, you know, rich, the elite that are controlling all that, living quite comfortably, and everybody else is scraping by on powdered food, you know, little chunks of stuff manufactured by the government
corporation, right? I mean, and
hand it out.
And I'll spoil it if you haven't even seen the freaking Simpsons. I mean, like. It's
but you got to. I mean, they go every day, and you get your daily ration. You get a little bit of water.
You get a little cracker.
And you get a bag of Soylent Red and a bag of Soylent Yellow, and then they have the new and amazing, everybody's favorite,
Soylent
Green.
Yeah.
And they just look like little colored crackers.
Yeah. Kind of like Ritz crackers, sort of, but not. I bet they don't taste as
they're
good.
Square.
No, are they? Are they square?
Yeah, the
Soylent
crackers are square. That's
been
ages.
They're like crackers. Yeah.
But
like Zestas.
They always got the impression that the red one was supposed to simulate meat, the yellow was supposed to simulate like grains, and green was supposed to simulate vegetables.
Mm. Yeah, I guess that makes sense.
But the green is not vegetable.
No.
It's meat.
It's meat. But, it's bad kind of.
But that's one I remember as a kid.
But they
kid.
Do. I
you
mean,
know,
they
that was a movie that. As a kid, I mean, I remember that movie vividly. That was, like I said, it's a pretty bleak fucking movie.
But
it's
in a world of overpopulation, even suicide has become like a something that they're not.
Oh yeah, that's the other thing. Yeah, going home.
Yep, you can decide to end your life because life is terribly difficult and hard. And if you can't,
they have these little
anymore.
They have these little sort of like really mellow kind of new age clinics that you can go to where they'll euthanize you.
And if you've lived your life in
it's not like the suicide booths on Futurama.
Well, like if everything, you go home to an apartment with no air conditioning in the hot summer because ozone layer's destroyed, and you know global warming and everything else, and you know you're hot all the time, you're sweaty, you never get any kind of like break from it all, and then you go to this building. And they lay you out in a bed.
Well, there's
and
like
you
there's
know
a,
everything's well, super the thing, comfortable. The thing is and they like, play the music you want to hear.
Yeah,
and they show you a background.
When you've been in like all these crowded rooms with all these people, you get this big room all to yourself.
Yeah.
And then you're laying there on a nice, comfortable bed. It's cool. You tell them what kind of music you like.
Mm-hmm.
And they show you like they show them the films of like fields of flowers and animals.
Yeah, you get to see beauty
like sunshine,
in a stark world where.
And you just lay there
exists.
And you mellow out on this couch, basically. And listen, you know, seeing pretty stuff and listening to nice music, and they euthanize you.
And that's exactly where the movie.
And they call it. They
turn.
Call it. They call it going home.
Because Thorne goes, Charlton Heston goes, and yet another movie with Charlton Heston in it, where the world ends, and so to speak.
He had that run there, man, where he was the man,
dude. Absolutely. If you didn't have Charlton Heston in your vision of the end of the world, it just wasn't even.
When you had Planet of the Apes, Omega Man, and Silent Green, that era there, sure. He was the shit, man.
But he goes and he follows Ever G. Robinson's character's
Saul.
Follows his body as it makes its way down the machinery that moves the.
Yeah, when the waste disposal squad picks it up.
And it
and
lands.
They don't take it to the waste disposal plant.
It goes to the Soylent factory and becomes Soylent Green. And that's when, you know, the whole Soylent Green is people.
The movie also has Chuck Connors in it.
Yeah.
The great Chuck.
Edward G. Robinson, though, for a food source.
Right.
Fed quite a few people.
Mm. Yeah, that's why I love that Simpsons. It's all Soylent Green. Looks like a box of cereal and it says, now with more girls.
Yeah, he's got this. Soylent cereal.
But yeah, that's a pretty stark, bleak future where you start to see like people eating other people to live. I mean, it's all done in the.
But see, but it's so sort of desensitized and like done in this. You know, it's not like this crazy, out of control cannibal future. You know what I mean?
No.
It's like the you got to realize like how fucking sad the situation is.
Sure, your protein is extracted and put into a cracker.
That's what they have to because they realize that. But the line that they're selling is that it's coming from the ocean. It's made from like
but,
ocean.
Yeah, you hear later in the film that the oceans are dead.
Yeah.
That there's nothing left. The plankton's gone.
Which,
like,
yeah, I mean, you got to realize that what a bleak fucking situation it is to where they have to start using dead people to make food to keep the rest of the people alive. You know?
Which is a pretty, pretty bleak future. And in that movie, you had a lot of, in that story in particular, you had a lot of like crime based on just how life had to be. You know, you basically could not make it without having to commit crime. Like, even Thorne had to do bad things.
Well, I mean, everybody...
With the food riots and everything else.
Everybody's kind of looking out for themselves.
And he had to, because the amount of food you got just wasn't enough.
Yeah.
And so, like,
everybody's got to do something to get by, yeah.
And, which kind of brings us into, like... Our next category of dystopia, and that's the crime dystopia, the one where crime has gotten so incredibly out of control that no longer is the criminal considered a citizen, and that his crime is not who he is. It's just something he does. But when it, hopefully, you know, we never really get to that. But I mean, it's considered that.
I don't
like
know,
it's,
man. That'd be kind of cool.
Well, it's considered that, like, if a person commits a crime, he is rehabilitated, you know, by sent to prison. Not punished, but rehabilitated. And if it's, that's why, you know, they call them penitentiaries, because you're to do penance. And that's to be rehabilitated. And we've decided that that's the kind of system we want. And, I mean, as far as it goes, most of the countries of the world have abolished the death penalty. There isn't the specter of all-encompassing, you know, death for everyone.
I mean, most of the nations of the Western world.
Yeah, most of the nations of the Western world, I should say.
It's true.
But at any rate, you know, a certain amount of humanity is given to those that do commit crime because they're not considered their crimes. They're considered people who have committed crimes. And in the crime dystopia, you really have the type of society that's gotten so out of control, whether through liberal lawmaking and you know, maybe a too much of a understanding of criminals, and everything's gotten so much out of control that nobody's really taking care of the problems at hand. So you have like the cases in like
what movie?
What with,
well, you got to give a movie for an example, or nobody will know what you're talking about.
Well, I mean, okay, like Escape from New York.
Escape from
like,
New York. Okay.
There's so much incredible crime.
You know, everything's got to have a
that they
pop,
had to,
you got to have a pop culture reference.
Well, yeah. To where you have to...
Books only go so far.
Yeah. Like, with Escape from New York, from New you York. Have, like, the entire
well, like, wouldn't, like,
island
like,
of Manhattan.
Like what we were started out with, like, Judge Dredd and martial law?
Yeah, well, with Judge Dredd, you have, like, the...
And isn't that very similar?
That's, yeah, the crime sort of dystopia with, like...
But definitely Escape from New York.
So incredibly powerful imagery of, like... gangs running loose, and then you have like A Clockwork Orange,
yeah,
where you have like roaming gangs of people, and they're, you know, they're even dressed, you know, and we see that in day-to-day life where people dress alike in gang,
like the Warriors,
like the Warriors,
like the Warriors.
Well, a real life example would be those militias in like Liberia, like especially in Monrovia, and you see them like, you know, the little kids fighting the Civil War, and they're all like wearing like, you know, one gang's all got pink on, and one's, you know, wearing,
yeah,
like
just total like
one
energy.
Guy's got like a life preserver on just because it's orange or something.
Well, then you have your bandana gangs too.
Yeah,
you know, the Western American bandana gangs. Like, you know, you got a red bandana, you got a blue bandana. It works like that, and then you get a black bandana, and then, you know, it's just all about that. But, you know, in The Clockwork Orange, you had, like, you know, it was their English gangs. So, you know, they had to have bowler hats and white shirts. And
the one gang was dressed up like Nazis.
Yeah. And then, you know, they basically went out and committed a hell of a lot of, like, really hardcore crimes. Rape.
Ultraviolence.
Yeah, ultraviolence. A little bit of the ultraviolence. They go to the bar, drink a lot of milk, and then go beat each other.
It's not just milk. It's milk plus.
Milk plus.
Plus. And then there's, like, ultraviolence, rape, and classical music.
Yeah. And in that...
well, that's different from Escape from New York, which is mostly... That's a gulag kind of situation.
Yeah. Well, it's a situation of where science has allowed... Or not science, I should say society has allowed crime to become so...
Society is to blame?
Yeah.
It's a fair call.
The punks rung
still
loose.
Still hurts.
You know? You get, like, so many... You know, the youth has run wild... For whatever reason, because there's no, like, nobody taking care of their own, you know, as far as their children are concerned.
A lot of movies around that time of, like, you know, oh, the kids are going crazy, gangs. Well, like, every Bronson movie after, like, 1980, you know.
Yeah, I mean, right?
Did, like,
a half dozen,
know,
Death Wish movies.
Yeah, Death Wish 1 through 15.
Nine.
I don't know. Where they're just, you know, like, guys are running around the street, and they're, like, in the inner city. And,
oh, yeah.
And there's nothing
well,
but, like... You know,
it
burning
was the
cars
80s.
And,
you know.
But the punishment is part of the really
everything
stark
like
part
Detroit.
Of that type
oh,
of
yeah.
dystopia.
Oh, yeah, it was the 80s. So you had, like, white people living in the suburbs. Like, the concept of going into the city
was
the most horrifying thing.
Yeah, the urban landscape was that of just ultra.
Like, there was
stuff going to
be burning constantly.
Yeah, like...
And there's not there are non-white people there. And they let them just walk around
I mean, they shot
stuff.
Escape
like
from New York in East St. Louis. And I've been to East St. Louis, and it looks like that all the time.
It's,
there's plane in the middle of the, you
no
know.
No offense to St. Louis, but...
East St.
Yeah.
Louis is a shithole.
East St. Louis is some
And I apologize to anybody who listens to this show who lives in East St. Louis,
yeah,
but you know you live in a shithole. I'm sorry.
I'm sure you know it better than we do.
So, you know, you get, like, crazy gangs. Yeah, but... Then you have your own little, like, microcosm of society going on inside, like, the crime. You have, like, the Duke of New York, you know, and Isaac Hayes. Word Isaac Hayes in his car with
chandeliers.
You know,
yeah, that movie's got one hell of a cast.
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, yeah.
Adrian Barboobs.
That's right.
Harry Dean Stanton.
That's right. Brain.
Lee Van Cleef. Donald Pleasance.
Yep. Yeah,
Ernest Borgnine.
Oh,
me and Kurt.
Indeed. I mean, that has always been one of my favorite movies, and, like, the type of dystopia that describes is one of, like, ultra crime, and the only way to deal with the punishment of those who commit crime is the ultimate punishment of giving them over to the criminals themselves. Or, you know, dealing with them in such a way is that the punishment is almost like a crime by the state. You know, you have in, like, Clockwork Orange, where his, like, he's being brainwashed into not doing crime anymore. And is that, like, a reasonable way to deal with criminals, is to brainwash them to basically make them to where they're docile, to where they cannot any longer commit a crime? I mean, there's always been talk of, like, pedophiles, convicted pedophiles being, like, surgically castrated or chemically castrated in order for them to...
Well, punishment goes in waves like that. I mean, when you were talking about penitentiaries before and where the word came from, a lot of those places, there were, like, two... In the United States, there's two different types. There's a kind where... And I think there was, like, the Philadelphia kind of jails, and then there was the New York kind of jails, and one of them, you'd just... all day, you would sit in a cell, and this is, like, in the 1800s. You'd sit in a cell, and you would turn this crank, and every day you had to turn it 1,205 times. And that's all you did? All day, is turn this crank. And people were going shitbag crazy, and like, sticking their arms in the crank and trying to kill themselves. And they're like, this is not working.
The Wheel of Pain in Conan.
Yeah, it was all solitary confinement.
They had this all day long.
It wasn't solitary, but I think it was like in Bombay or somewhere in India. The punishment was like they had this big wheel, and basically they climbed the wheel and turned it. And I don't know if it actually did anything.
No,
it was
like none of those.
Like a
things.
Giant hamster wheel?
Well, yeah, but it was like, you know, the stuff long enough or wide enough for, like, you know, 100 people to be on it all the time.
See, when I was young, like, we were told that there was a place in Kentucky, like, that was a camp where they sent, like, juvenile delinquents, and the entire thing was called the Mud Project. And it was like they would have, like, a hill, and at the bottom of the hill was, like, a ravine, and the ravine was full of mud. And they would take mud in whatever wheelbarrows up the hill and dump it into some kind of, like, trough.
Yeah,
and dump it into this thing, I mean, and then at the end of the day, they would dump it all back at the bottom of the hill again, like into the ravine.
Nice. Well, it's like going to Leavenworth and making gravel, you know, that
making
whole, like, thing.
Big rocks into little rocks.
Yeah, you know, it's like condemned to hard labor. But
yeah, I mean,
that's after that. I mean, they stopped doing those solitary stuff because people thought that they would, you know, it's like you'd think about what you had done wrong while you're turning this crank. Instead, people were going nuts because they didn't have contact with anybody else, and every day all you did was turn that fucking thing. And
then they would just start dying. Escape from New York is like the thing where it's so bad, like, the government just gives up on you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they just, you know, there's like one big giant hole that they flush them all down. You know,
yeah,
there's like
exactly.
this place
there's
you go in.
There's no need,
like,
for rehabilitation.
Everything is effectively a life sentence. Like, you're just dumped in there and you're just going to spend the
And then
rest
that,
of your,
you have the fear of being a criminal because you'd be put into this situation where, you know, you're stuck in a prison where everybody, you know, is at. And there's nobody taking care of the thing. They build a wall around it, and that's it. And they make sure that nobody can get out, and that's all they do. So you have, like, you know, you have the Duke of New York running things, and then, like, you know, everybody, like, gladiatorial-type battles, you know, taking place, and just, you know, crazy, crazy murders, you know.
And the what do they call the Chuds in that movie?
The ones that live, like, in the lower levels?
Yeah, the eight people.
Oh, like the crazies or whatever they are that come out at night?
Yeah.
Yeah, that are just, like, bottom feeders. But, they just completely have lost all humanity. And I mean, it's pretty bleak, but, you know, if crime were to ever get that bad, or, you know, maybe, you know, you'd wind up with a situation where an area that was so crime-ridden couldn't be controlled any longer, so you basically mine the bridges that go into it, and you build a big wall around it while you have the chance, you know. And, start going out there with helicopters and making sure nobody swims across and whatever. They had a little boat in the beginning of the movie that they bombed out of the water, and you know, they weren't putting up with that shit, man. Even though there was a huge wall and the chances of making it up to the wall were pretty slim, still, man, they weren't putting up with that shit. So, yeah, that was it. But then, you know, that's along the same sort of lines as the type of dystopia where you're in a future so bleak and dark that it almost transcends, like, today's day and age, entirely, where you have, like, you know, things have gone incredibly wrong ecologically, and you have, you know, people don't even remember what it was like to be able to walk outside and just have a picnic with their family or anything like that. And then you have, like, the kind of, you know, they don't remember that there were trees and animals and things like that, and wildlife at all.
You mean like Logan's Run?
No, I mean more like Blade Runner.
Well, Logan's Run, they live in the bubble cities. They've never seen the outside world. They think they don't know what it's like.
That's so, like, I don't know. I mean, it's not where I was going. But,
I don't know if that would be a dystopia, technically. I mean, it seems pretty bad, but all those people seem fairly happy.
But, I mean, it's
run around without bras.
I mean, I can see that. I mean, it's
that's more
on
like...
On the surface, Logan's Run is, I mean, it seems really, but I think it's a pretty unsuccessful way to run, you know, for a society to function.
It's a failed utopia is,
I mean,
what it is.
I don't know. I mean, you can beam girls into your apartment.
Well, that's the thing. I mean,
it's sort of a statement of, to me, it's kind of a statement about that kind of like the narcissism and hedonism of youth gone to the, you know, like he said, like living in a mall.
Yeah, I mean, that's
like, everybody's
that's exactly
young and good looking
is.
And no, but yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like they're just having fun all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But nobody really ever does anything.
And you can only live till you're 30.
Yeah, and then, you know, nobody gets old. But it's not a really functioning, successful society, really.
Nobody in the mall over 30.
But it's all about being young and, you know, looking good and having casual sex. And it's just...
So, like, in that movie, you wind up with, like, the... There has to be a special police force that maintains the solidity of the system in order for it to survive, I suppose, everybody that... is over the age of 30 has to be destroyed, you know, or reborn. So they think they're being reborn because nobody is born to a natural birth. Like everybody's kind of born in like, they're not born in utero. So they're
like, the whole point of it is like when they escape the city and they get to the outside and they, you know, they see the sun and they feel like actual warmth of sunlight on them and they, you know, real fresh air and trees and, you know,
looking for sanctuary.
Yeah, I mean, which, you know, which is the sort of the fabled, legendary place where you
living
can,
in a city where, like, we're living in a society where you die by the age of 30, and you don't want to die, and you start to get old, and, you know, you get in your late 20s, and then you start to realize your mortality, even though you've been escaping it in your entire life, and then you wind up with, like, you start to look for a way to get out of it, and then there's the hope of sanctuary, and, like, then they send the Sandman to try to find out where a sanctuary might be, you know, and everybody who's got that little Ankh, you know, symbol, you know, is supposed
to.
I
think that's reasonably dystopian. I mean, it's not
right, but I mean, it's not just hell breaking loose or anything.
No. Like I said, it's dystopian in that it's a failed utopia.
Yeah.
It's like a utopia with such an incredible flaw in it.
Yeah,
it makes it a dystopia.
Yeah, it's
just
not
by
a really,
that.
Really successful. But but what you're talking about with Blade Runner is Blade Runner. That,
I think the
that constitutes like.
I don't know if that. I mean, it is. I think probably the book it's based on is more.
Is certainly
apropos
yeah.
to the conversation
yeah,
than the movie.
Yeah,
but
I say, well, but even the book is like it sort of. It contains a lot of different elements because, within the book, you've got this sort of. What the movie touches on, what I think what you're just meant is the sort of the urban decay,
sure,
which is similar to like the Soylent Green stuff. You know, you've got the kind of the issue with resources and overpopulation, and it's got that kind of a sense of like,
well, it's become to the point where like a replicant, an animal or a human, well, I want to discuss more on the animal issue, like. The whole thing with the snake. Is that snake real?
Well, yeah.
I can't
afford a real
snake.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean,
you
that's...
You get a robot
but,
snake cheaper
yeah,
than
in,
an actual
in
real
in the
snake.
Book, in the book, that factors in much
snake.
Much more... in the book where they are electric.
Replicant.
Well, in the book, they are electric.
Yeah, they're
really,
all...
Okay.
Everything is.
I mean, they're all the electric animals. But that whole thing, in the way in the book, is like, yeah, where there's been such a dramatic ecological destruction and devastation... to where there is very little natural life left. But, and then the people are so sort of disconnected from all of the real, the sort of organic world, that it's all like, to have an animal is in a way it's something that sort of allows them to reconnect with this idea of that. And like, obviously the regular, you know, the regular person can't afford to have an actual animal.
Yeah.
But you've got to have an animal. So like in the book, he has the electric, he winds up with the electric sheep and he keeps it on the roof. And it's like, it's this thing where like,
it's a Furby.
Yeah. You know, but
basically, they appear real and they act real and stuff like that.
But then, like, obviously the rich people have
real
animals.
The book
animals,
and the movie,
you know,
need to be taken, like, separately.
I mean, the book is, or the movie is kind of, it's not different from the book, but the book has a lot, obviously has a lot more. The movie is kind of a streamlined one of the storylines, one of the aspects of it.
Yeah.
I mean, because in the book, he is hunting down androids, and there's, and it deals with a lot of the issues that are in the movie as well. But then there's a lot more. There's a lot more social.
There's the religious aspect.
Yeah, and there's the whole, there's a lot of issues with like the mass media and like media, you know, controlling.
Well, sure.
The flow of information and how you perceive the world and
there's also,
you know, all
the,
that, but it's,
and artificial like moods and all that stuff.
Yeah, again, it just, you know, more sort of desensitizing you as an individual.
Yeah, and then there's, you know, the underlying current of like who is real and who is not, or what is real and what is not.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, you know, the movie touches on that as well, but there's, you know, but that's something where there's problems with atmospheric radiation in the book, because, and it's, like I said, you know, but this idea of like being able to go up on the roof and like touch this animal, and like there being an animal there, it's like this way that people find to like reconnect with this world that's not accessible to them anymore. They can't go out like walking in the woods. They can't see birds in the air, you know.
No.
But it's sort of this memory of like what it used to be. But obviously, you know, real animals are just impossible for most people. So they have these electric, you know, replicants.
Well, yeah, and then you have like Roy and his fellow replicants can't get together. Like their 4-year lifespan, you know, they're nearing the end of their 4-year lifespan. They've revolted and made it way back to Earth to try to make it to the Tyrell Corporation so they can try to figure out a way to get more life out of their bodies. And then they find that there's no way to do that. And then, you know, but they're still, they're actually developing emotions. You know, they're feeling their own mortality. You know, probably one of the most basest of emotions is to know that one day you're going to die. And here they are, they're facing their own death, and then they're starting to feel, they're worried about it, and they know that they're constructs, but they're, you know, they want something else. You know, they want to know that there's going to be something afterwards. And there's the religious aspect in the book that's not in the movie as much, on the understanding that if you're real, there's an afterlife. If you're not real, there's kind of nothing, you know. And there's no need for there to be an afterlife for those who aren't real. But these people are developing feelings, and they want there to be something, and there isn't. And it sort of, it touches on the,
but as I said, it has a lot of it has multiple aspects of the concept of dystopia.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got, like I said, sort of the, sort of, the, I said, with the ecological issues and, you know, the lack of resources, and then it's got the, sort of the overpopulation, and there's the aspects of technology becoming no longer, technology becoming almost a burden in and of itself. Like, it's so massive. I mean, the technology is being so fully integrated into your life that it's almost starts to get in the way of you living your life, rather than, you know, it being the sort of the Victorian industrial revolution concept of like all this stuff's going to make your life better, but then it just becomes more and more, and it just becomes so intrusive, you know. Yeah, you've got that where, like, you know, you've got so many, you've got technology has become so immediately and like intimately integrated into every aspect of your life that it becomes all your life is. You know, like you wind up sitting in a room.
Well, yeah, and it's like a drug in the book, you know, where you can't deal with getting up in the morning without going to your Penfield mood organ and
well,
dialing
see,
in your mood.
That, and that brings us, you know, kind of into the sort of lifestyle that's given up in Brave New World, where
Soma.
You have like Soma,
which
is the all-encompassing drug of like to make life tolerable.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but that has more of a
Well, you just zombifies you.
Yeah, yeah. You're able to deal. You know, there's no need for there to be, like, any thoughts of ill will or sadness or any kind of emotion at all, except for just one of kind of, you know, things
there's
are great.
There's just sort of a mild... contentment, for lack of a better word.
But yeah, I mean, it's
just kind
it's
of like, you're like sort of permanently okay with everything.
It's a true opiate. But it's like one that you can be fine with any situation given to you because you're able to dope yourself into thinking that not thinking.
It's kind of funny that that book was written way before he actually heavily got into drugs.
Yeah, yeah. Aldous Huxley was actually, you know, he did a lot of mescaline, apparently, and LSD, and,
never have read The Doors
during the
on
hippie
Perception.
Days.
No, he was early hippies because he died like in 63, I think.
Yeah,
so I think
yeah.
I read that recently. Hmm. He was in the like the psychoanalytical phase of eating a bunch of lab grade mescaline. And
yeah, that's just like with Leary and his group, you know. But like, I mean, in that you had classes of people, you know. In the Brave New World, in the book, you had like classes of people based on their genetic disposition. Like,
were they all clones?
No, but they were bred. Like, if you were
an alpha,
you were part of the intelligentsia, or so to speak, you were, you know, top echelon of people.
Yeah.
You had the more involved jobs. You got to talk to people. You got to go places. You got to, you know, you had to have you had more of an executive role in lifestyle.
You're kind of like a party member.
Yeah, you know, and you could actually, you know, go places and do things.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could have, like, the executive lifestyle. But then you had, like, gammas that were made, like, that they were actually dumbed down on purpose. Like, they were, like, a chromosome was changed in them in order to make them sort of, you know, subhuman in a way. You know, so they would be able to deal with their lifestyle of being, like, you know...
Yeah.
Doing menial tasks, being, you know, in order for them to have a, you know, because if you had a menial job, you know, and you saw people that had, like, a better job, you would think, oh, man, they have a better job than I do, and that, and there lies the strife. So you make people who can only have a job like this, and they feel great about it because, you know, they're able, their capabilities are only where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had, like, the epsilons that were, like, you know, the lowest of the low class. You know, where they were, like, the people that, like, shovel garbage and that kind of thing. And, you know, they were, like, they weren't the day-to-day, like, runners of society, like somebody who was a skilled laborer like a gamma. They would be more like somebody who just, you know, waste disposal and that kind of thing. So, yeah, and in that, everybody takes the drug Soma, which is just like an opiate. And then there's no hangover from it, so nobody ever feels like they've done too much of it or anything. And part of the, and in the book, you wind up with people, they say stuff like, you know, they're in a meeting or something, and the meeting gets boring, and they kind of, the girl in it that's a friend of John Savage, like, takes the Soma to make it through the rest of the meeting because she can't even handle, you know, listening
but
to
again,
boss
I mean,
talk.
Again, that has a lot of different aspects. I mean, it has the sort of the suppression of the individual. It also has the kind of, you know, the tech, you know, technology becoming not a tool that we use to make life better, but something that's, you know, it's been sort of manipulated in a way that it's, we've become its victims,
well,
rather than its
like the
than its masters.
It's,
you know,
the type of dystopia that we described in Logan's Run, where it's like the failed utopia. Essentially, to see what the mechanisms are, is that's where the, you know, you're making people, you know, stupid in order for them to do a job that needs to be done. You know, rather than them trying to strive towards a better job, that you're artificially making them, like, stupid. So they that's the only job they can do. And then you have the type. Then you have the reservations with people, like, living out their lives as kind of the savages, you know, where they don't have Soma and they don't have, like, the regimented lifestyle that the people that live in the cities do, and that they don't know anything that's going on in those.
Yeah.
And then John the Savage is made into like he's brought from like the savage lands to the cities, and then like he's shown about and he actually, you know, like sees what's going on, but he can't understand why anybody would, like, you know, he's like, none of you do anything, you know, like he sees the futility of all of what they do. It's like everybody does everything for like just nothing. Like, there's no reason for it all. So he, in the end, he takes Soma to try to feel, because he feels so awful about it. He takes Soma, and in order to feel, or to stop feeling what he's feeling, and then he winds up, he's like, understands it, you know, like he commits suicide. So I mean, the whole, you know, it's just, it's kind of rough, but it's satire. It's definitely, you know,
it's also a poke at the trend then, and it's kind of the trend now in the psychiatric fields, where they're just like, here, just take a pill.
And that's exactly it. And then for a while, like a few years back, they actually introduced a mood altering drug. Now Soma is a generic term, they made a drug that's a mood altering drug called Soma. That's his brand name.
Well, it has something to do with some chemical in the brain that's got that as a root, or
in there. I'm not really sure what it's for, but like, are you talking about that specific drug or
the name Soma?
No, I'm not sure what its name is, but like, but it is in the book, mood altering drug, and then they go and make a mood altering drug, but they name it Soma. It's like somebody didn't go in the fact, you know, we probably ought to not name it that, you know, it's going to, you know, it doesn't take too much of a push into making that, like, you know, sure, self-realizing prophecy there. Yeah. And then people, like, having a backlash against it, you know, it's not like Zoloft or anything like that is the name in some book, yeah, you know, it's Soma. And that, you know, just, it kind of freaks me out that they would even approach that name, but they did, you know, I guess it's just...
It's much easier than taking the time to think up one on your own.
Well, thinking, that's the whole idea.
They don't do thinking, that.
Speaking of which, I was...
Thinking hurts, and you don't want to do that.
I was reading, just yesterday, I was rereading Neuromancer.
Ah.
It's written in, what, 82? Published 84. In 82? Okay. And he was talking about, you know, one of the little technology brokers they go to on the street having, you know, plugs behind her ear, like cyberware, mm-hmm, and all that stuff. But he specifically refers to it as a Microsoft.
Yeah.
It was just kind of weird that there hasn't been, like, a lawsuit over that.
Well, I mean, if he
had named something Microsoft.
Yeah, it's not a brand name. It's a thing. Yeah, so
I guess,
yeah,
just because it's a small M instead of a large M.
Well, and that I believe brings us to one of my favorite types of dystopian views, and that's the
Don't use that word.
It's been so overused. Yeah, it's.
But I guess you have.
Yeah,
to.
You really kind of got. Yeah. You know, but it's a. I mean, when it's Bruce Sterling, kind of came up with the whole thing. It's cyberpunk.
He's not very good. I don't like
him. I don't really like his work, but he sort of defined it. You know, he made it, like, real. He made it, like, understandable. He was part of the group that, like, put cyberpunk where it's at. And then you have Neuromancer being written and William Gibson's finest work. I really like Count Zero better, but, like, it's, like, you get, like, Neuromancer's... Somebody else want to talk about this, because it's been a while since I've read Neuromancer, but, like, Adam, you read it recently.
Well, I'm still reading it, actually.
Yeah, but so. Go into it for us. You know,
well, it almost seems old hat now, because it didn't exist back then. It was, like, the first, yeah, you know, there was, yeah, the first mention of something.
Well,
like that.
It's
now
the description
it's
of a,
like,
society whose technology has blossomed so much that it's almost uncontrollable. Like, it has it's a will of its own, sort of, that... The type of technology available is so powerful that it has to be regulated from within. Like, you can't have, like, you can't stop it in the physical world. Like, it transcends it. Like, it's its own world. It's cyberspace.
And it's something that it's become so fully integrated into everyday life that you can't exist without it.
Exactly.
You know, we're like, you can't not have a computer.
Yeah.
The equivalent, you know, I mean, like, there's no way to function outside of that effectively, because it's everywhere, it's in everything.
Yeah, not just a computer, but, like,
but
pretty much cyberware.
Yeah, I mean, kind of... yeah, I mean, the you know, but to...
Well, you can't even have, like, as much as a bank account without a computer.
Yeah, yeah. And they talk about how, like, actual cash is, used mostly in illegal transactions.
Exactly.
Yeah, everything else is done, you know, virtually.
Right. In fact, if you're carrying a lot of cash on you, it's considered like, you know.
Yeah, quasi legal.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, yeah, you know, technology and essentially like computerization, and it's obviously the concept of cyberspace and all that stuff, you know, the kind of inside the computer world and all that stuff, which,
well, yeah,
which, yeah, like he said, like nowadays, you know, it seems cliched almost, this sort of Matrix-esque crap, you know, but in back in the day, you know, back in the time when that book was written, it was some pretty amazing and profound
stuff. When a lot of people
were
still using punch cards to get programs done.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And you look at the concepts that he came up with, but,
well, it's
but the idea of, like, you
late
know,
70s idea
of it, that of it being, you know, and it all being sort of becoming so personalized that it's actually, you know, a part of your body. Like, you're directly physically connected.
Well,
yeah, and you can die from using.
Yeah, exactly.
To all this technology,
and also if you do die, they can just download your personality into a, well, what would now be called a microchip or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't remember what they called it.
Well, that's because computing power has become such
they have those
that
those biochip things.
Yeah, you're able to like simulate a person entirely, which is the reason why they have the Turing cops in there, because the simulation people can do things, you know.
Or like, the artificial intelligence can. Because, I mean,
yeah,
obviously, if it's artificial intelligence, it's sentient.
Yeah, that's the thing, yeah. And I mean, that's why the Turing cops are around. They test you to see if you're, you know, basically human or not. And there's the whole like the way they go about it and everything. And
AIs are effectively outlawed.
Yeah.
Right. And
because they don't have
incredibly regulated.
Yeah.
Well, because they don't
they can't
want
really
there to
be like a sentient, free-thinking machine.
Except for that one in the high Earth orbit.
Exactly.
Wintermute.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's the part I just got to. Yeah. I read the book like straight out of high school. So
but
I
think, you know, it's mostly sort of
it's been a long time since.
It's mostly sort of a, you know, kind of a, I always took it as kind of a scare tactic thing about, you know, the obviously, technology, to develop, it needs to be unregulated. People need to be able to, you know, it needs to grow. Like the internet, you know, it just needs to be created and let go. But then, obviously, you know, it can get out of control.
Well, it's sort of technology run amok, but in a way that is still being... It's sort of a manipulation of people. You know, it's powerful
like
one
I said,
person...
We become its victims and not its masters.
Yeah.
You know?
In the book Neuromancer, it's kind of like, well, you know, Case manipulates and does all this stuff with the technology and these programs. But then, in fact, you know, like 80 pages in is where I am now, they just figured out that they're being manipulated through Armitage by an AI.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I can't remember exactly, and I'm glad I can't remember. I can't remember the point that it's, you know, manipulating them. I don't really remember the plot, which is good because it's all kind of new.
It's a great book.
Yeah, it really is.
I mean, it was the first.
But then
it's
there's also other books that are along those same lines that also touch in the same ways that, like, Neuromancer is more of like the tech noir sort of, you know, dark, you know, very, you know, hard-boiled type of futuristic novel where you have
and
like
it's not like so
on.
It's not inaccessible
and,
or anything.
And the thing is,
ninjas in it.
And the thing is, at the time, it's really unprecedented. But later on, it actually proved itself to be a way that they dealt with people like that. Case was actually like the part of his brain that could go like into the cyberspace was taken out, so he could not go into cyberspace.
He was poisoned.
Yeah, actually. Yeah. But then you had like Kevin Mitnick, you know, got busted for hacking, and what do? They, you know, you can't touch a computer. You know, that's his punishment, is that he can no longer go online. He can't can't touch a computer.
What does the poor man do for porn?
You know, and he actually talks about it, and he's saying, like, it was almost impossible to I was breaking the law every day, and I wasn't even trying.
Mm-hmm.
It was like I couldn't really do anything without touching a computer. I couldn't make a phone call. Mm-hmm. Without it being a computer, he said he couldn't own a cell phone because it had internet capabilities. Mm. You know, and to try to find dumbed down devices that he could use legally, because, you know, he was looking at having to go back to prison if he fucked up, and if they wanted to, they could have, you know, sent him back to prison. You know, he was like, I couldn't do anything. You know, I couldn't make my way through life without having to do these things. But yeah, I mean, he had like William Gibson basically describe the kind of lifestyle one would have to be in order to make it through life without touching a computer, by there being computers so ubiquitous. And, yeah, we wound up, like, being able to go back into cyberspace, but it was a surgical, you know, deal to be able to do it. And
Is that where he had to go to the Finn? And go
yeah,
to
he had to, yeah.
Actually, Armitage redid it. Kind of, anyway.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, but there's, I don't know if any of you have read Snow Crash or not. Snow Crash.
I've read it.
Snow Crash describes a, almost the same kind of cyberspace, like, or cyberpunk sort of dystopia where the United States is essentially broken down and become bankrupt, and there's no longer like a United States of America. There is, but it doesn't really own the land that it's in, so there isn't like a United States. It's still called the United States, but like everything has sort of been like there, instead of being like a government that controls an area, you have like the little, they're called burb claves in the book, but they're the walled in neighborhoods that like rich people kind of live in, you know, where you've got the fake gate in front. But in this
gated communities,
and then you have,
that's what,
like,
we call them nowadays.
Well,
like most, like a fair chunk of Orange County,
but they're actually their own governmental like units. Like,
okay,
if you live in a gated community, you have to have a passport to get in and out of the place, and then you have to be able to you're a citizen of the place. And there's all sorts of different ones. There's ones that are like white supremacist ones where only white people can live. There's ones that are like, I think there was one for Jamaicans or something, mm-hmm, like that. And then there was the one that was Little Hong Kong, or you know, it was like a little Hong Kong neighborhood, and then there was like the, but yeah, the main character, which is hero protagonist, that's his name in the book, which is, but he's a pizza delivery driver, and he works for the mafia. He actually works for Uncle Enzo's Pizza, and Uncle Enzo's like the leader of the mafia, which is like a corporation, and they compete against other corporations, which is also like a recurring theme in the cyberpunk books. In
corporate oligarchy.
Yeah, is where corporations instead of governments are really in control. There isn't, governments are sort of subservient to the corporations. They basically enact laws to work with the corporations so their ends are met.
Isn't too far off.
No, which isn't at all. I mean, but like almost every other one we've talked about is a stark statement of what is going on now. It's just a, you know, taken to the nth degree.
Yeah, I mean, most dystopian fiction or just, you know, or the films, I mean, it's social commentary on the present. And I mean, most, you know, the concept of the dystopia, I think, mostly exists to prove that the infeasibility of the concept of utopia.
Yeah.
Like, there can never be this perfect, you know, Eden-like society where everybody's just perfectly happy all the time. You
because
know?
In order to do so, you'll have to make somebody really unhappy.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea, you know, the concept of dystopia exists just to prove the impossibility.
It
of
is.
Utopia.
It's a majority of people are able to live on the backs of the minority sort of situation. I mean, like, there is like,
I think, what?
Well, the majority of people are, you know, what I mean to say is, like, you feel like you're alone, like you can't you like in most dystopian books and movies, you don't see like a large scale revolt of any kind. It's always one person against the masses, you know, or the machinery that keeps, and people are, you know, they're like, well, I can't give up what little I have to support your argument. So I'm going to go along with the majority on this and make sure that I get mine, you know, because there's no way I'm giving up what I've scraped together. And that seems to be a recurring theme in a lot of these. And it's just such that, like, we've, you know.
Well, yeah, that's one of the sad things that is always apparent in it, is that, like, most of the people accept it. mm-hmm. and put up with it. Like, as horrible as the living conditions are in whatever particular dystopia it is.
Well, sure.
People will just endure it.
Well, in the ways that they go about, like, dealing with it.
You know, there's the rare individual who will stand up and, you know, and fight in their own, even in what small way that, you know, even like the small resistance that Winston or that Sam Lowry in Brazil, you know, the small moments of resistance are way out of the ordinary. Most people, you can, you know, the most horrible, shitty, you know, the today in this, you know, in the world, people living in horrible, shitty conditions that they just endure it.
Yeah, it's sort of, you eke out what you can. You know, that's about the best you can ever hope to do.
That's the sort of the sad, you know, so there's the rare individuals that do revolt even in small ways. They may not, you know, tear down the evil empire and, you know, liberate everybody, but just even the small acts of resistance.
And in very few of the books, in very few of the situations that we've described, does anybody actually try to end the system entirely. Also, they more or less try to get out from underneath it, and that's about the extent of it. It's not really like a I'm the hero of the book. It's more like I'm the victim of the book, and this is my story. Because very often they don't make it.
Yeah.
They end up, Winston Smith is turned back into a drone. What was the guy in Brazil?
Sam Lowry.
Sam Lowry is basically lobotomized.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have, like, John Savage kills himself.
Yeah.
Well, Alex kind of makes it out sort of in an anti-hero sort of way.
Mm,
when he's brainwashed, and then he's finally like, ah, I can be violent again.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's kind of like a yay for him, boo for us. You know?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, like, you don't, but it's still, I mean.
Most of them are just kind of like social commentary going, if we continue on our present course, this is what's going to happen in somewhere or another. And, you know, they exaggerate certain elements for effect.
Yeah, it's hyperbole for effect. Yeah, yeah. They'll focus on one particular aspect of modern society that is, you know, unpleasant or possibly harmful, you know what I mean? And they'll really exaggerate that one particular thing.
Well, it's also one of the reasons why I try to avoid the what-if scenario of dystopias, like the ones described in, like, Man in a High Tower or, like, Fatherland, where Nazis win, you know,
Man in High Castle.
Thing. Yeah, Man in a High Castle.
Yeah,
Fatherland was kind of a cool book.
Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I'd like to touch on, like, in a different show sometime. A sort of what if episode,
the alternate,
alternate universe,
history
alternate history of the world. But yeah, I think that's it for us tonight. And thanks for listening. We don't have an email to read, and we're actually not in the news bunker this time. We're over at Derek's
once again.
The swinging bachelor pad.
Yes, the future pad, which is apropos for this show. It looks like 2001 in this room, and it's very, very cool.
It's my own private dystopia every day.
Right, right.
Yeah, I think the closest thing you're going to get to Soylent Green is Chicken and a Biscuit, which is on sale at Kroger.
Really? Chicken and a Biscuit is great.
And it's not made out of people,
as far as I know.
If it is,
and arguably it's not chicken.
No, it's not chicken. They're crackers hosed with sprayed. They're crackers sprayed with chicken broth.
And they're so good.
And
that's what they tell you.
They are pretty tasty.
And just so next time, we'll find out from Adam all the different Inna biscuits that there are in Australia.
Yes.
Oh, I forgot about
there
that.
There are.
I think I still have the email from that.
The world Inna biscuit.
So we'll touch back with you about that. There's more than just chicken.
Inna biscuit.
They do have Vegemite Inna biscuit.
Yeah. So they can have that.
They had bacon Inna biscuit too.
Bacon and a biscuit.
Those clever sons of bitches.
Well, that was like that German.
That's probably. See, that's crackers sprayed with bacon fat.
All right. Well, from Destructomundo, this is James.
And Ted.
Adam.
And me.
Good night.
Good night.